Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, metaphysics in the movies is the topic, and I want to take you to the world of movies. Well, naturally, in this presentation, the examples that I have of trailers and the movie clips are from American films. That's a sad reality because, of course, in all our countries there is a blooming movie industry, and we could find a lot of examples to use those films as well. Yet people watch these Hollywood films, and sometimes we can use them, or they can at least serve as some kind of a conversation starters with our friends. I had this experience actually with one of my family members who is not a Christian, at least not such a fanatic as I am. And he gave me one DVD film, which the trailer, I have one trailer from that film actually, the end of this session. It's called The Body. I don't know how many of you know, starring Antonio Banderas. It's a story about young Catholic priest who is sent by Vatican to Jerusalem to investigate a recent archaeological finding. They find an old first century tomb from Jerusalem. And in that tomb, there are bones of a crucified man. And he is sent to investigate whether these are the bones of Jesus Christ, or actually his actual mission is to go and prove that they are not the bones of Jesus. But the whole film raises very relevant question when you think about the resurrection of Jesus. All the questions that we think are important even theologically, whether Jesus rose bodily, what would happen to Christianity if the bones of Jesus were found, would we have to revise Christianity, would that be the end of Christianity? All those questions were in that movie quite explicitly, but in a typical Hollywood style, the answer was left open. And when I returned that film to my relative, and he asked me, did you look and what did you like about it? We had, for the first time, very interesting, serious conversation about what does the resurrection of Jesus mean for Christianity? Is it important that Jesus was raised bodily from the grave? What if his bones were found? What would that mean for Christianity? And for me, that was kind of a revelation to a boy who comes from a very, how would I say, very pietistic background. When I was a young kid, movies were sin. You didn't go to the cinema. I remember one time my very good friend invited me, would you come and we go to cinema together? I said, oh, horrible cinema, what film? Ten Commandments. What have they done to Moses? You know, Ten Commandments in cinema, that's terrible, unspiritual. Well, I don't know if I have liberalized or my view about Christianity and things like that has broadened and deepened. But nowadays I find that even in secular films, of course we have to be critical, and we look at that also with few strokes soon. Even in secular films which are not made explicitly for Christian consumption. So we are not talking today about Passion of the Christ, or not even Narnia explicitly, or things like that. But I want to give some examples of completely secular films where you suddenly find in the middle of the film embedded things that raise very deep metaphysical questions. And I find them very exciting. Now let me give you the first short clip from a film. I'm not going to say which movie this is. We come back to it later if it all works fine. Let's see. Those who have seen the film, of course, no worries. But listen carefully what this lady says.
I had an experience. I can't prove it. I can't even explain it. But everything that I know as a human being, everything that I am tells me
that it was real. I was given something wonderful, something that changed me forever. A vision of the universe that tells us undeniably how tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us that we belong to something that is greater than ourselves, that we are not, that none of us are alone. I wish I could share that. I wish that everyone, if even for one moment, could feel that awe and humility and a hope. But that continues to be my wish.
Wow. I mean, isn't that powerful? I mean, that's, now, after a clip like that, I would like to give an altar call. Anybody here who wants to give his life to the Lord? Well, we come back to this clip, but if you listen very carefully, you notice that it raises very important epistemological questions. This person is trying to prove something out of her experience. And I can't prove it to other people, but I had this experience. That's a very interesting epistemological point. Now, from common grace to grace in Christ, you have in the handouts, which you find in your app, which I finally got working after a few days, you can find this outline, not the PowerPoints, but the overall outline. And when we are talking about films, I think we are moving in the area of general revelation. Not necessarily, and most of the time when we are talking about secular films, we're not moving in the area of special revelation. They are they raise the questions and issues which people are confronted with all the time, just for the simple reason that they are human beings made in the image of God. And they live in the world created by God, even if they consciously try to suppress that knowledge. And Paul writes about this, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. Later on in chapter 2, he talks about the testimony which is in the heart. Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, namely the written in the tablets of stone. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness. Now, this is the general revelation, which no one can escape because they are human beings created in the image of God. That's why the great existential questions and metaphysical questions remain the same. God has built us in such a way that we ask questions that are supposed to be pointers to something greater than ourselves and something which is beyond, not from this world. Now, I hope you don't mind taking one verse out of context and giving it a little bit different meaning, but I find this a beautiful depiction of what we see happening in the films. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy he went to and sold all he had and bought that DVD. I mean, the field. So kingdom of heaven is hidden in the field on this world. So I see also these films as an example of how something from the kingdom of heaven like flashes through or is hidden in the movie world. And then this brings my point closer to home. Movies can serve as culturally relevant conversation starters with our unbelieving friends. I read from Acts chapter 17, which you can see over there, Paul standing up in Athens at the Areopagus, and he said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. I don't remember which translation. I think it's NIV probably. So there is this altar to an unknown God. It has a very interesting history, actually, if you want to study it. But to a certain extent, every human being has this altar in his heart to God, which is unknown to him. And we should proclaim it to people. What is that thing that resonates in their hearts when they see these clues of the kingdom shining through these movies? One more. Acts 17, chapter 17, verses 27 to 28, where Paul speaks that God has created all men from one, and he set the boundaries for them. And God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. And this is interesting what Paul is doing here. He's quoting two poets. Now he's not quoting Old Testament scripture. He's not even quoting Jesus. The first time, "For in him we live and move and have our being," he's referring to Cretan philosopher Epimenides. So he had read his philosophers and poets. Second quote, "We are his offspring," from, how do you pronounce it, Cilician? Cilician? Stoic philosopher Aratus. So Paul knew the surrounding culture, and he could refer to those points there which speak to our common humanity in order to proclaim to them the gospel about Jesus Christ. So I think this is how the movies can serve us for the kingdom of God, even sometimes when they are not necessarily Christian or spiritual films that are meant to be, you know, preaching us directly the message. I believe those movies have also their place. But I find it interesting that Paul does not quote scriptures. This sometimes what seems so obvious to us and dear to us makes no sense to other people. I remember as a young man, I noticed, by the way, that when I'm getting closer to 50, I'm all the time prefacing everything that when I was young, that's strange. Well, anyway, when I was young, I remember one discussion with a lady in downtown Helsinki. I gave her a leaflet, a tract, and I said, "You know, would you like to, you know, hear the message about Jesus?" And Jesus said, "You must be born again." And I always remember the look in her face. She looked at me very strange and said, "But I'm a Christian." She didn't understand when I used the term born again. And I thought that's the word that Jesus used. She thought I am trying to proclaim some Buddhist reincarnation or something like that. So now I've learned, hopefully. So I think this is just lays the foundation, what can be the role of films when we think about them as conversation starters. There is in the handouts and in these papers, in the app, there's a couple of links to Dallas Theological Seminary, their table podcast, which I recommend to you. And in one of them, Robert Johnston, who is the professor of theology and culture at Fuller Theological Seminary, he says this very, very valuable quote. "The world is being shaped by a series of stories, myths. We can critique it, we can say it shouldn't be, but in rural villages in Ghana, they saw Titanic. Our children are looking at the latest Disney movie 53 times a year and can give the dialogue verbatim. That is a shaping influence in terms of how you process reality so that we can say, And I believe Scripture is authoritative, but that authoritative text is heard in conversation with that read on reality that's coming from our television and our media and our film and so on. And that's both good and bad, but as Christians, we need to be aware of that. Be conversant, be part of that conversation, or we risk being both irrelevant and handicapped in terms of our own discipleship and growth as Christians in the world. That's a citation worth remembering. Now, in the films, you have to pay attention to the underlying worldview in those films. And of course, who better knew this than C.S. Lewis? There's one quote from him who said that books that openly defend materialism do not make us materialists, but rather books that only presuppose and implicate materialistic worldviews. I think that same holds true for the films. The movie version from the Book of Narnia, you all know, very strong Christian worldview. And the opposite side, atheist Bill Pullman, I think was his name, his books, which he consciously, as far as I can tell, and if I remember correctly, wrote as a kind of a counter story of Narnia, the Golden Compass. There is this idea about the church who is opposing all kind of great, wonderful things, and I don't want to go too much into that. But this just shows that movie directors, screenwriters, they have a worldview, and they will bring it into the films. Oh, what have they done to Moses? Here, my friend asked me, what is my favorite movie? And after a little thinking, I thought that definitely one of my favorites is the good old Ten Commandments. There's one true Moses, and his name is Charlton Heston. Just like the only true Tarzan is Johnny Weissmuller for my generation. That yodel is, there's nothing like that. And what have they done to Moses in this new version, Exodus, Gods and Kings? I think Reverend Robert Barton, whose YouTube channel is full of different kind of movie analysis, makes this good observation about this movie Exodus. The book of Exodus, the biblical story, in the Bible, there Moses is utterly fascinated by God and drawn even deeper into union with God's mind and purpose. So transformed was he after one encounter that his face shone with the brightness of divine glory. How far this is from Christian Bale's brooding Moses, who seems to wish that God would just leave him alone. And he's talking with this irritating young boy there. The reduction of the Exodus to the story of political liberation from a tyrannical system of government, that's what happened in this new version. Exodus is not telling, the original story in the Bible, is not telling a story primarily of political liberation, though that is part of it, and you can actually see some hints of that even in that 1959 Ten Commandments version. There's certain kind of liberation story there, but rather a story of spiritual liberation from false gods. And this new version strips the biblical story from all its divine mystery. My short summary of the film is that Moses hits his head and starts seeing a little kid talking to this kid whom he thinks is God. And in the end, he hits his head again, and then they drink tea with the boy in the end. End of story. So what happens if you hit your head in the stone? The results, Exodus, Gods and Kings. And that is a sad thing that happens to the films. Okay, let's go back to the first clip. And I will tell you from what movie this is. Now, you remember that first very impassioned evangelistic speech in the beginning by a movie character called Ellie Arroway, who is a hardcore scientist who only believes what she can prove scientifically. And earlier, at the beginning of the film, She has this discussion with Matthew, how do you pronounce? Thank you. Who represents a priest, some kind of a liberal priest. Yet they talk about something very interesting, and listen very closely.
I read your book.
Here we go.
Would you like me to quote you? Ironically, the thing that people are the most hungry for, meaning, is the one thing that science hasn't been able to give them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on. It's like you're saying that science killed God. What if science simply revealed that he never existed in the first place?
I think we're gonna need to get some air.
What?
And a few more of these.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ooh, a little chilly out here.
Yeah, this is nice.
I got one for you.
What do you got?
Occam's Razor. You've ever heard of it?
Occam's Razor? It sounds like some slasher movie.
No, Occam's Razor. It's a basic scientific principle. And it says, all things being equal, the simplest explanation tends to be the right one.
Makes sense to me.
All right. So what's more likely? Thank you.
You're welcome.
An all-powerful, mysterious God created the universe and then decided not to give any proof of his existence? Or that he simply doesn't exist at all, and that we created him so we wouldn't have to feel so small and alone?
I don't know. I couldn't imagine living in a world where God didn't exist. You know, I wouldn't want to.
How do you know you're not deluding yourself? I mean, for me, I'd need proof.
Proof? Did you love your father? Your dad, did you love him?
Yes, very much.
Prove it.
That's it, and then the story goes on. Very interesting discussion. Occam's Razor, all the philosophers were, whoa, now it's something interesting. Now, when you remember how it ends, there is the Ellie Arroway that played by Jodie Foster. In the end, she becomes what I would say a believer. Now, this is from the movie Contact, by the story by Carl Sagan. There's even this funny line when they are listening to the outer space to hear any signal of extraterrestrial life, and then they receive the signal. They make the contact. And they realize that there are intelligent life out there somewhere. And they receive the plan of some kind of machine that can send Ellie to meet those aliens out there. And there are a lot of things. And after she returns, she tries to tell what she experienced, but something has happened. The recorder that she had with her, there is, I don't remember, was it 18 minutes or 18 hours, just no empty white noise or something. It's all, there's nothing. So all she has when she comes back is her own experience. And now she has become a believer. She realizes in the world there are things you just can't prove scientifically. There's this funny line when they are debating whether they should send her or not. Someone says that we don't even know whether the aliens believe in God. Of course, there are some religious figures who oppose this kind of trip to the outer edges of the universe. But this science fiction film is one example which suddenly in the middle of the film raises these interesting questions, which are the basics of our Christian faith. Is there a God, and how do you prove there is a God? Prove to me that you love your spouse. How do you prove that? Okay. Now I'm going to a few other examples. I don't know how many of you know the story of Robinson Crusoe. Do you know? Oh, yes. I thought that only in Finland they make everybody read the story in the school. Okay. So I don't have to tell you too much about what the story is about. But the guy is stranded in the island, spends 28 years in a solitary island, meets the local native, this kind of cannibal, whom he names Friday because that's the day when he finds finds this guy. And there are new kind of there are new films that follow the same motif of being stranded in a in an island, or in the latest version, in the Mars. Castaway, where Tom Hanks is kind of Robinson Crusoe figure. His only friend is his volleyball Wilson. In Mars, or in Martian, Matt Damon is talking to his plants and trying to get message across back to the Earth that he's alive, and they're trying to save him. It repeats the same basic storyline. Now, I came across with Robinson Crusoe by Pierce Brosnan. This is a movie from 1997. And again, I thought, well, I like to look at it. And suddenly in the middle of that film, in this version, there was a very interesting dialogue, which I didn't remember, although they made us read Robinson Crusoe at school. But I never remember reading something like that. So let me play to you that clip. And it has even English subtitles. But now, lights please, because this is a little bit dark. Notice this discussion and see what they have. Then I explain what they have done. But it's interesting.
Friday, I'd like to talk to you about God.
God?
Your maker, the creator. God. He made everything. He made you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you, God.
Crocodile, huh?
Before long time, no land, only water.
As in Genesis.
Pakia live in the water. He make Timpopo. He make Tampopo.
He make the sun and the moon, aye?
Mm-hmm. Sun and moon marry, they make baby, man. Make all men, make me.
No. God made you.
Pakia.
You can't worship a crocodile.
Why not? Teeth of crocodile.
And is this crocodile, this Pakia, tell you to eat the flesh of your enemies?
Make strong. You eat fish, swim good. You eat lizard, climb good. You eat hard, make strong.
This is pagan blasphemy, Friday. The true God is greater and more powerful. The true God is love. He teaches us to love our enemies. Pakia is not God.
Show me God.
I can't show you God.
I show you, Pakia. You show God.
You cannot see God. He's in the spirit. He's in the soul.
I see spirits in the trees. I see spirit in fish and animals. I see everywhere.
Here. Here is God. Here is the living proof of God, his sacred word. This is the living testament to his love, his wisdom, his divine plan here.
Wait, I see no God.
You have to read it. Now look at it, son, you heathen savage. This blasphemy and your soul shall be damned to eternal torments.
I no like your God. I no like you.
Forgive all those who trespass against us, against you, Lord.
Well, it didn't quite end the way we hoped, isn't it? Well, in the original book, there is not this kind of dialogue. But when I saw this dialogue, I thought of, usually what the Hollywood does, they don't add religious elements, they remove them. So what I did, I went to the library and I got the original book, the unbridged version. And I started reading Robinson Crusoe. And I realized that what they made us read at school was only those short versions. Because the true background for this story is, as you know, the author Daniel Defoe writes a story about this guy who goes to the sea voyage and gets stranded on a solitary island. There is no discussion like this between Friday and Robinson Crusoe. But the true story, which is always edited out, even in these versions, of course, there is nothing religious. Actually, they've changed the story into a triumph of human spirit. But in the original story, oh, it's so beautiful. Robinson Crusoe gets stranded on that island. After many, many years, he starts thinking to him by himself there, sitting on the beach, that why, out of all these people, he alone survived. What kind of providence was that? Actually, the story begins by reminding that this is a story that is told with a very with a religious spirit, and it's a kind of a prodigal son story. His parents tell him that if you go out on your own ways now, you're following your passions and things like that, it is not going to end well with you. But finally, he finds himself in this island for many, many years alone, and he starts thinking, why did I survive? And there's this beautiful scene in the book where he's sitting, as I said, on the beach, and he looks at the starry sky and starts thinking, who made all these things? Who made it so that when I plant a seed, it will grow and give food to me? Then he remembers that before he left to the sea voyage, somebody whom he didn't know donated a Bible to him. So he swims to the wreck. What do you call this? The ship is there in the waters. He swims there and finds the Bible and starts reading the Bible. So he thinks first how God revealed himself in the nature. Then he reads scripture. Then he gets very sick because he's using tobacco. And he's almost dying, and he sees this strange dream where he sees this bright being coming from the sky with a spear in his hand and said, because you did not serve God in your lifetime, now you are going to die. And he wakes up. He's sweating, he's wet, and he runs to the Bible, and he opens Psalm 50, verse 15, which says, who remembers? Because I can remember the airport security, you see. I can remember that in Finnish. Honor me, call upon my name in your time of trouble, and I will help you, and you shall honor me. Something like that. You can check it, Psalm 50, verse 15. And there's this beautiful description in the original book that he lays the book aside, actually he throws it aside and he kneels down and he said, I cry to Jesus Christ to come and save me. And his whole life changes because Jesus saves him. It's like reading kind of modern testimony. It's a beautiful story. And it doesn't end there. Now here, he has met Friday, who is this heathen, cannibal. He saved Friday. In the original story, Robinson Crusoe gently and lovingly leads Friday to know the Christ. And later on, they save Friday's father and some of their own villagers, and they also lead them to know Christ. In the end, all these cannibals are Christ-believing Christians. And the big question that is in the original book, and I promised I'd talk to you about the films, but this is fantastic. You have to read the book. This much about the book. The original idea, I think, there is that when we always ask that, what happens to those who have never heard about Christ? Think about this story in that light. God can throw a man in a solitary island for 28 years to meet one person, to share the gospel with him, and the gospel reaches those people who have never heard about Christ. That's the original Robinson Crusoe. And Pierce Brosnan and this movie made a move to the right direction. In the end of this film, Pierce Brosnan, or the Robinson Crusoe by Pierce Brosnan, is more like a coming to Friday's side, that, oh yes, we have the same God and things like that. So, well. But I had to share that story because it's beautiful. Okay, not that again. Then here's an example of the couple of later films. I'll show you one trailer from this one in a minute. Prometheus. I don't know how many of you have seen this Prometheus film. You have. Okay. We could speak a lot about that. But it is actually, it raises the interesting question about where do we come from? It's a science fiction where a group of scientists travel to outer space because they have come to the conclusion that our DNA is so complicated that it must have been designed. So they go out to the space because they think that they can find our engineers who left their DNA to this world. So they are kind of godlike beings. And in the middle of the film, there is very interesting short dialogue because one of the scientists, a lady, carries a cross in her neck. And they have this discussion. The guy asks, what happens to that if we find our engineers, namely those who made us? Do you remember this moment? And the answer is something like this, that, well, who made the makers? And then again, the action starts and movie moves on. So if you have seen the film and your friend has seen the film who doesn't know the Christ, you can always bring this up and say, do you remember that moment in that film? That was interesting. First of all, that we are so complicated or we so much bear the signs of design that it cannot be a chance. It just cannot be, you know, coincidence. Somebody made us. And of course, in the film, they finally find our makers, and it's not kind of a happy ending. There's one of the, to my taste, one of the funniest moments in the movie history is there when this one of the androids, which is there, and then this one old guy who thinks that when he can meet the engineers, he can get healed from his illness. They have all the keys for immortal life. Well, the guy dies. The android gets his head ripped off. And the last words of this old man when he's dying is said, there is nothing. Namely, you know, you die and that's it. And the android says, I know. Have a nice journey. It is so funny. You know, do they both end the same way? Now, this is the question that the book of Ecclesiastes asks. Are we like animals who dies, their spirit goes down, or is man's spirit going back to God who gave it? Are we like an animal? Are we like animals? Do we have the same end, or are we just like machines? And the movie Transcendence, which is later production, actually raises this question. What is man? What is consciousness? There is this movement called transhumanism. And they talk about the idea of what is next in human evolution. So if you believe that we've been evolved randomly all to this point, from the more simple life forms. So if the evolution continues like that, what is next? And the transhumanist movement talks about this next stage of evolution. And there is a philosopher, if I remember his name right, Stanley Kurtz, who has played with the idea that he's looking for a day, probably in his lifetime, at least that's his hope, when we can download our consciousness into internet. And that's the thought or what's behind this story. So let's look.
Please welcome my partner in science and in life, Dr. Will Castor.
The path to building superintelligence requires us to unlock the most fundamental secrets of the universe. Imagine a machine with a full range of human emotion. Its analytical power will be greater than the collective intelligence of every person in the history of the world. Some scientists refer to this as the singularity.
Professor?
I call it transcendence.
A series of attacks conducted by a radical anti-tech group known as Rift.
They hit AI labs all over the country.
We lost decades of research and development.
It's radiation poisoning. The bullet must have been laced with it. The effect is irreversible.
Will's body is dying, but his mind is a pattern of electrical signals. We can upload his consciousness. We can save him.
Not like this. Assuming that this works,
If we missed anything, a thought, a childhood memory, how will you know who you're dealing with?
Evelyn.
Oh my God.
I can't feel anything.
I'm here.
You need to get me online. I need more power.
It may be intelligent, it may even be sentient. This is not well.
Shut it down.
Shut it down? It's him!
Your friends crossed the line. They don't know the danger.
This is astounding.
So how do we fight it?
You can't. An AI is like any intelligence. It has needs.
The real will die.
It'll start to evolve.
Where's the machine?
To influence. Perhaps the entire world.
Where are you going?
Everywhere.
Now that was very interesting. So it raises this big question. What does it mean to be a human being? And what is a soul? What is consciousness? Are we just machines made out of meat? And if our consciousness is only bits of information, can it be downloaded to the machine? So what? There are lots of different movies that play with the same idea. For example, Robot's Life by Robin Williams. It's a beautiful modernized Pinocchio story. Very touching. You don't know where the lines of machine and human being, where do they finally blur, so that you don't know, has the machine become so human that it's no more machine, or has a human being become so machine that it's no more human being? Where does this line go? And my own philosophical answer, put in a very crude way, is that will never happen. Human soul is something specific. And I usually ask the people ask them to think this question: is my TV set bothered by the fact that I'm staring at it? You know, if someone is staring at you, you know, somewhere, you get, why is he looking at me all the time? My TV set is not bothered by it, because he's not a conscious being, of course. We are something different. Now, this is one of my favorites, and I go through it not too quickly. I want to show you one great clip from there again. I Am Legend, it's a retelling of the story, of the very old story called The Last Man on Earth. Some medical experiment goes horribly wrong. They thought they could cure all cancer and everything, but I think you Americans, you say it goes south. Is that the right way to put it? Yeah. It goes horribly wrong. And people start dying, and those who survive, they start turning into some kind of vampires. And I remember I rented this movie once because I thought Will Smith did such an excellent job in the Independence Day, so this must be something great. And the first hour, finally, I got a bit bored because he was just training his abs and, you know, driving in the Manhattan and killing these dark things. But suddenly, in the middle of the film, happens again something. Just when you think all hope is gone, and he thinks he is alone, and he's desperately sending this message everywhere. My name is Robert Neville. I'm a survivor living in New York. If there's anybody I can provide, he can hardly provide for himself, but he's promising to provide. If there is anybody out there, please, you are not alone, says the man who thinks he is completely alone. And then just at a certain very important movie turns, there comes a lady, Anna, and her son, who are immune to this terrible virus. And they save Robert Neville to his hiding place somewhere in New York. At the beginning of the film, there is this scene, which I just put on my Facebook as a cover photo, because many people miss that in the film, and it's very important. Now, you can see a little butterfly. If you go to internet, you can see articles or YouTubes that explain to you the secret of the butterfly code in the film. But what they miss this one. which is underneath the butterfly. Yes, there is the recurring butterfly in the movie, and you can see butterflies in different times of the films. But there is this text, which just very briefly you can see at the beginning of the film. God still loves us. Do we still love God? And you almost pay no attention to it, but it's very important to the film. Now, then you come to this moment when Anna and Robert have met, and Robert explains all these tests that he has made to try to save humankind, and Anna is horrified. She said, "Oh my God." Robert says, "God had nothing to do with this. We did it ourselves." But then comes something very interesting. Now, you as a Christian, you can recognize something very important in this following clip. Listen closely. This is probably one of the most captivating movie scenes in this type of films.
Oh.
Wow. The problem of evil. How can God allow something like this to happen in the world? And after this, the vampires attack again. Now, in the end of this film, Dr. Neville finds the cure. And Anna is saved. Neville dies. Anna is saved. And she takes this cure and finds this colony that she only believes exists. And when she comes to the big gates of this colony and they open these heavy iron gates, the first thing you see there in the background and the first thing you hear is the church tower and the church bells ringing. Now think about that. So actually, in that light, it's not so bad film after all. But it raises this question about the problem of evil in a very powerful way. You can find in the YouTube clips where atheists are gloating over this. Oh, here's a great atheist, you know, challenge to Christianity. There is no God, there is no God. We do have answers to these questions as Christian apologists. And maybe your friend has seen this film. It's a good way to start the discussion. Now, that's the body, Antonio Banderas. Maybe I don't bother you with that. With that trailer, but okay, Bill Gates. Now, I'd like to open the floor for discussion. These are just a few examples that I quickly put together. There's a new interest in biblical themes in films. Some are successful, some are less successful in terms of how they portray these messages. The Passion of Christ probably started it because Hollywood noticed that, oh yes, people are interested in religion. Everybody laughed. Probably thought, oh yeah, Jesus story. Then came Noah, not particularly fond of it myself. Exodus. Kingdom of Heaven was this kind of historical spectacle, or supposed to be, and it would provide a fantastic conversation starter to correct the misrepresentation of Crusade history, because it's so unhistorical, its portrayal. Ridley Scott is just kind of projecting anachronistically our questions to that time, which were not real. Salahuddin was not such a humanist as he is portrayed in the film. He enjoyed seeing heads being chopped. Fireproof is a new, this kind of Christian movie, and perhaps you know more, a good quality Christian films also, which have come lately. This kind of a story about, there is a bit romance, but it's also how to, yeah, well, I don't want to spoil your movie experience with that, but that's a good one. Okay, thank you very much. This was the presentation. Now I'm open to your comments and corrections.